Let me tell you, we have a very interesting show for you here on Impact today. And for those of you who aren't accustomed to being with us, hey, hold on to your seats and your hats and anything else you've got, because this show is going to talk about communism. And that's something we haven't dealt with on Impact before. And we are very, very pleased to have an expert with us. His name is Dr. Francis Nigel Lee. His background is extremely fascinating. He started out in South Africa, where he grew up. He's got all these degrees from there. He's gone to schools I've never even heard of. The University of Cape Town. You know, here I went to L.A. State. Give me a break. He has degrees in Christian philosophy, communist philosophy. He's the author of numerous texts. He's working on 8 books presently. I'm sitting here holding a book that's about 4 inches, 5 inches thick called, here we go, Communist Eschatology. I think I've got it. He's here in this country. He's leaving for England this evening. He's been here for about 2 weeks, going around giving lectures, and he is an expert on the communist ideology. And without further ado, Dr. Lee, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Ken. Nice to be on your program.
That accent, I always like that accent, you know. But let me ask you something. How did you become an expert on communism? How did it all happen?
I suppose the short answer to that is when I was a university student, and many years ago, about 30 years ago, and I looked around the campus, I found that the people who were making the most noise there and who claimed to have the answer to the world's problems were left-wingers in general and communists in particular. So I wondered to myself, what makes these people tick?
Well, did you find out?
Yeah, I read everything that they publish in English and in German with the official imprimatur of the Communist Party book rooms, and now I know what makes them tick.
What makes them tick?
They are very religious people, fanatically dedicated to try to bring about what they would regard as a better world. And many of them being selfless people, they have a great capacity for sacrifice and to dispense with short-term comfort in order to, they would hope, bring about a better world as they see it.
Well, does bringing about a better world, is the way to achieve that, as Khrushchev said, we will bury you? How is that bringing about a better world?
What Khrushchev actually meant was, Americans, we will be present at your funeral. In other words, we will outlast and outlive you. And your grandchildren will live under communism. So you better come to terms with it now. That was what he meant.
Well, I noticed that shortly thereafter, Khrushchev disappeared from the scene. He wasn't around too much longer after Disneyland.
That's right.
Or his attempt to visit Disneyland, I should say. This text I have in front of me, this is about 1,200 pages long. Apparently it was originally published in 1974. Communist Eschatology. How is it you came to write this book?
In any religion, there are two things which intrigue me the most. First, what that particular religion believes about where everything came from. And I wrote my MA in philosophy on that, on communist genesiology. That is to say, if communists reject, as they do, the biblical account of where we came from, found principally in Genesis 1, 2, and 3, what then do they believe, and how do they believe everything came into being, how things got started? Now, this book we've got here in the studio, Ken, deals not with what communists think, how everything started, but the kind of world communists would like to turn the present world into, should they ever get the power. In other words, it's the communist doctrine of the future. and what they expect will happen in the future if and when they control things.
Well, now, how is that different than Karl Marx's manifesto, and number one? And number two is you wrote this book, or I should say it was published in 1974. It had to take you years to write this, or certainly a long time. How did it come to have the things predicted in your text, and obviously I haven't read it, have they come to pass? Or have any of them come to pass?
The Communist Manifesto, Ken, you asked about, which was written by Marx and his associate Engels, rather sets out a program of communist takeover, the technique of takeover, rather than where they think everything came from and how they think everything will end up if they're successful. Although even in the Communist Manifesto, there are a list of about 10 points programmatically, and then the conviction that they're bound to win. I mentioned the manifesto together with scores of other communist documents in that book. But again, this book, after a short introduction about the history of Marxist communism, really majors on what they would like to do in Western countries should they succeed in bringing about their downfall. And briefly, there are three phases which are supposed to happen after the collapse of, say, the United States in a communist revolution. First, the dictatorship of the proletariat, which, after it consolidates the takeover, is supposed to develop into what they call socialism. And then finally, when they've succeeded in getting every nation in the world committed to socialism, only then can any socialistic nation go forward to communism, which is why they will tell you, quite rightly, that Red China and the Soviet Union have never yet been communist countries. They're socialist countries waiting to get the United States to go socialist before any and all of them can go forward together to communism.
Well, that's... So the Soviet Union is not truly communistic at this point?
No, it's never claimed to be.
Well, that's interesting. It's socialistic.
Socialist, committed to communism, as distinct from British Labour Party socialism, which is anti-communist.
Well, now, you mentioned that they were a religious people in some way, but yet communists are supposed to be anti-God. Isn't there a dichotomy there?
Well, I guess it all depends on how you define religion. The word religion is taken from the Latin religio, which simply means conscientiousness. So anyone who's conscientious is religious, whether he believes in a supreme being or not. The communists are very, very conscientious about what they believe in. Of course, they deny the existence of any god outside of the universe, but in their writings, they often suggest two things. First, that the universe is so real and always has been that they treat it as if it was divine. Second, especially in the writings of Marx, but also his associates, man, that is future man, that is communist man, is regarded as being divine. In one place, Marx says, there must be no god placed on a level with the divinity of man. So they're moving forward toward divinity, if you put it in those terms, and the divinity being the communist man of the future.
You know, I recognize that perhaps you're not fully up to speed on, because you've been traveling over the world over the last few weeks, but one would have to be on Mars not to have seen what's been going on with the Berlin Wall, with what's going on in Czechoslovakia, Romania, the Eastern European countries. It seems to me, I look around, I say, is communism collapsing and dying before my very eyes? What is going on over there? And is this something good for us? What do you think?
Well, communism cannot be dying simply because we don't yet have communism anywhere.
Oh, well,
the
okay,
most one
that's
could
true.
Say is that socialism in Iron Curtain countries is in serious trouble. Whether it's terminal or not, we'll have to see. Of course, I hope it is terminal, because I'm strongly anti-communist and anti-socialist too. But what is happening, I think, right now, the last several weeks, is significant. I think it shows, amongst many other things, the complete inadequacy of the economies of the Iron Curtain countries, and in some of those countries, serious cultural problems, racial problems, which they're unable to cope with, hence the clamor for secession. But all of this really has little to do with communism. It's little more than a lot of big hiccups as socialism tries to regroup, to streamline its tattered economy. Second, the situation we now have in the Iron Curtain countries is in some respects very similar to the situation in the Soviet Union from about 1921 to 25, when after a period of war communism, the economy practically collapsed. Lenin immediately imported capitalists into the Soviet Union under what he called the new economic policy and justified it. And of course, once the economy had been saved from collapse, why, then they went ahead, business as usual, recommitted to socialism.
I'm your attorney host, Ken Sadden. In our studio in Anaheim is Dr. Francis Nigel Lee, who has had a career that most people would certainly envy, author of numerous texts, working on eight more, a lecturer, teacher, scholar, and an expert on communism. If you read this man's itinerary, it'd make your head spin. He's leaving for England and Australia and God knows where. But in any event, we're pleased to have him with us in our studio. And, Doctor, when we were taking a break there for a moment, you mentioned something to me about a communist ideology that had to do with the, you know, the earth blowing up or freezing up. Could you share that with our listeners?
I'd be happy to, Ken. According to communist writings of Marx and Lenin, but particularly of Marx's associate Engels, and principally Dialectics of Nature, which is still published, by the way, in the Soviet Union in various languages and circulated for communist propaganda worldwide. After the whole world goes communist, which they regard as inevitable, a stage will after that be reached when the state, that is the world state, will wither away, people will become moral by nature, and then the Communist Party will wither away, they say. And then man becomes humanist, but then the humanism turns into naturalism. Now, at this point, the earth starts to cool down. When that happens, people have to leave North America and Australia, where I live, and congregate round the equator and huddle together to get warmth. But then the earth goes on deep freezing. And so human life, they say, will die out, animal life and plant life. The earth will become a slab of ice, will fall into the sun, which likewise will have frozen up. And then the sun falls into the Milky Way, and a couple of million years later, after there is zero temperature throughout the cosmos, somehow, through inherently operative dialectical laws which have existed from all eternity past without recourse to God or a creator, the whole cosmos starts heating up again. And down through billions of years, life evolves on what will then be our planet or a planet similar to our planet, and that will gradually evolve into higher forms of life until finally you get a herd of monkeys practicing community of women, community of property, which evolve into man, the first communists. They call it primitive communism, until monogamy is invented, and that degenerates into slavery, and finally that leads to capitalism, and then there's another socialist revolution, and the whole process goes on into communism until finally the earth starts cooling down again, and the whole process goes on over and over and over and over again. Of all the errors in communist theory, I regard this particular prognostication as the most depressing and dreary.
Who how do they dream this stuff up? I mean, they must have been on drugs or something when they came up with this. Who could possibly predict this sort of thing happening millions and billions of years in the future?
Well, Friedrich Engels dreamed it up, and he was the lifelong associate of Karl Marx. The two of them together wrote the Communist Manifesto.
Well, I have to ask you this. First of all, because I'm fascinated by it, you indicated that what's been happening in Eastern Europe is a little more than a hiccup.
Yeah, a big hiccup.
There
are a couple of big hiccups, but only a couple of big hiccups, nothing more. Little to do with communist theory.
But a lot to do with socialistic revitalization,
perhaps? That's right, absolutely.
And where's the money going to come from to revitalize these so-called communist countries?
Probably from stupid Western capitalists who haven't bothered to read communist theory to beef up the really flagging Iron Curtain economies again, just like was done in the early 20s.
So they're going to use our money to rebuild.
That's right.
What you're saying.
That's what they want to do, yeah.
And everybody's going to get so excited about the fact that they've torn down the Berlin Wall, we're probably going to give it to them.
Remember what Lenin said? The West is so stupid, it will sell us the rope with which we will hang them.
Well, I hope to heaven that we don't, that somebody listens to what this man has to say. We invite your calls to Dr. Lee. 1-800-222-1190. What do you think about the communist Eastern Europe and what's happening in the world? Doctor, what do you think of glasnost and perestroika and all these words that suddenly have entered our language? What do they mean to you as an expert on this subject?
Regarding glasnost, it isn't all that recent a word. It is used some 40 times by Lenin himself, who died in the mid-20s. It means, of course, openness, to be frank, to be quite candid. It is the age-old principle of communist interrelationship to one another. Be frank, be self-critical, be that way in public, don't hold back, criticize yourself publicly, then we can see your shortcomings, then you can improve, and if we don't think you can improve, we can get rid of you. So it's just a revamp of that, and interestingly, still preserving the same Leninist word. It was used by Lenin, it was used by Khrushchev, by Brezhnev, and now currently, of course, by Gorbachev. Perestroika means economic restructuring. But there, too, a lot of economic restructuring was already done in the early days of communism in the Soviet Union in the 20s. So that, too, is not a recent concept.
Gorbachev seems to be more popular than the American president these days. I expect the man to get the Nobel Peace Prize. What is going on? Obviously, you're not the only scholar in the world on communist ideology. Is everybody missing the boat here?
Well, Gorbachev is a highly intelligent man. He is a committed Leninist. He has said, in the last 2 years many times that they're still fully committed to Leninism. And what they're trying to do is to revitalize the flagging state of Leninism in the Soviet Union. They recognize they've got economic problems. Sure, they'll always have them as long as the United States doesn't become socialist, which the U.S. doesn't want to do. So until the U.S. does become socialist, they're going to have problems in the Soviet Union. It must follow. It's one world. So what he's trying to do now is to use glasnost and especially perestroika to revitalize Leninism with the view of world takeover. Matter of fact, Gorbachev said, I think it was about 18 months ago, that there must be no doubt that they're still on course to work for a world under communism.
That's fascinating. All right, we've been speaking to Dr. Nigel Lee, an expert on the communists and the Communist Party. And, Doctor, we're going to take a short one, but while we do, I'd like you to ponder this. Do you think that the communists are trying to divert our attention from Central America and what they're doing down there with all this supposed good stuff happening in East Germany? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Boy, shortly after we've had our Turkey Day, our Thanksgiving Day, we certainly have a subject that makes us wonder what's going on in the world and to be thankful where we are. With us, Dr. Nigel Lee, an expert on the communists, and he's telling us what their master plan really is. And let me tell you, it's certainly changing my perceptions. Before we get back into it, however, the question I posed just before the break, we have a caller, Spiro, from Mission Viejo. Hello, Spiro. How you doing?
Hi. Very good. I'm on my car, and I was listening to the conversation that you had with Dr. Lee.
Yes.
Being born in Greece and lived through the communist takeover from 1946 to 1951 in Greece, I'm very familiar with the tactics they operate. I guess on this earth, a lot of millions of stupid people that they're camouflaged from the doctor, Lenin theory and Marxism. And once the communists, you know, they get the hold of you, from there on, few people making a good life and everybody else are slaves.
All right. Well, listen, did you see, is that what happened in your own perception when you were in Greece?
Well, during that communist takeover in Greece from 1946 to 1951, this is exactly what they tried to do. They tried to impose themselves, you know, with killings and fear and the rest of the stuff that go with it. Lucky enough, of course, for Greece that most of the people didn't buy all these nonsense, and eventually, you know, the war was over in 1952.
All right. Well, Spiro, thank you very much for your comment. We certainly appreciate it. And we have another caller, Randy from Laguna Niguel. Hello, Randy.
Hi, Ken. Good morning.
Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Dr. Lee.
Good morning, Randy.
Hi. I really appreciate, Ken, having somebody on your show that covers this topic, because I think it's very pertinent in this day and age. I didn't catch the first part of your conversation with Dr. Lee, but I guess he has written numerous books.
He's an expert, trust me.
Okay. And does he give basic lectures and so forth that is it throughout the nation or locally, or is there a somewhere that one can get a hold of him to listen to these lectures?
Randy, I live in Australia. Pardon me. I live in Australia these days. I left the United States for Australia 9 years ago to become a Presbyterian Theological Seminary professor. Now, I'm currently on my last day of about 16 days in the United States, during which time I've been doing little else than running around in circles, talking on a variety of subjects, principally on communism.
Uh-huh.
These lectures have been taped and are available here in Los Angeles.
Oh, great.
Where could he get them if he wanted to get them? Can you? We'll give that information out towards the end of the program.
Okay,
so
I'd like to make another comment, but I definitely feel 100% with our government, with this glasnost and everything going on, that I'm very upset with our officials. It seems like they're just selling us down the road to our enemies, and I know communism has always been on conquering the world, and I think this is just one thing with this Berlin Wall thing to let down or help them financially to bolster up their economy. And I was wondering, too, if Dr. Lee in one of his books or whatever does mention or covers the different organizations within the political system, basically with the ACLU, which had its basis with the Communist Workers' Party in the 1930s, which I think many, many people don't understand or know.
Only very briefly do I, in my books, mention communist fronts and fellow traveler fronts in the West, and then, too, only until about 1910, because the infiltration had started even before that. I'm chiefly interested in communist theory, that is to say, what they would like to achieve worldwide, their ultimate strategic goals. What you're talking about, Randy, is, of course, their immediate tactics in order to bring about takeover by communists of a country such as the United States. But sure, yeah, they infiltrate many organizations.
Yeah, and by becoming more informed, the people of the Americas can be more astute in regards to the political system and be aware of their political processes, and hopefully...
Now, there are books written, Randy, by what you're asking about, specific communist fronts in the United States, but they're not written by me, but they are available in the United States.
Okay.
All right, well, thank you very much for calling, Randy. You know, the problem that we have, my feeling is, since he mentioned the Americas, you know, when you're hungry and you're starving, you don't care who's offering you the loaf of bread. I mean, if it's a communist, if it's a capitalist, whoever it is, if you're starving and you've got a baby and you've got a family, you're going to reach for that loaf of bread. I mean, that's my theory. So one, of course, it might logically follow, then, well, gosh, let's help some of these countries out. Let's give them some of our grain. Let's give them this and that so they'll have full bellies and they will be receptive to our ideology. And then, of course, it winds up in the Marcos bank account somewhere in Switzerland, and it never gets to the people. So, I mean, is there a solution? How do you preach an ideology if the communists are going in there and offering these people, salvation, supposedly?
There's two questions here. First, I detect is whether the West should offer food to ailing Marxist economies now in order to feed starving people. Second, whether the Marxists are themselves offering food to starving people. To start with the last question first, yeah, sure they are. Marxists promise food and shelter, and not only that, but they deliver. If Marxists take over a poor country, they will deliver food and shelter, even if the West gives it to the Marxist functionaries to pass it on and to funnel it to the people, but it's only for a limited time. During that limited time, the Marxists say to the people, there you are, we have given you what we promised you, which is so, maybe not as much as the people hope to get, but some, undeniably so. And then after that, it's cut off. But during that time, they've got their propaganda and they're ready to use the same technique in another country. Now, when the West aids Marxist countries because of the people, reaches the people, it was intended to help. It's got to go through the Communist Party, and a large slice of that is hogged by the party functionaries, and that which is passed on to the people is passed on in the name of communism and not thanks to the United States, the generous donor. That's the whole problem.
We've been speaking to Dr. Francis Nigel Lee, born in England, lived here in the U.S. for a while, and now lives in Australia, an expert on communism and the Communist Party. We invite your calls. We've had a couple of interesting calls. If you'd like to speak with an expert on the communists, this is the place, 1-800-222-1190 here on K-Orange. That's 1-800-222-1190. Stay with us. This is Impact. I'm your attorney host, Ken Satin, but we're not talking about accidents or divorces or anything like that today. We're talking about the commies, and we have with us an expert, Dr. Francis Lee, who's here telling us all about their evil plans, a lot more than I knew about them, I'll tell you that. Doc, well, before we took a break a while back, I posed a question to you, and that is, do you think the communists are trying to divert our attention from Central America, from El Salvador, from Nicaragua, and those countries, with what they're doing, this glasnost, what they're doing in Eastern Europe, opening up the Berlin Wall?
Yeah, I'm sure that they hope to make the West less aware than even they would think the West is likely to be by re-diverting our attention away from Central America and what they're doing there to what they say they are doing in Eastern Europe. However, I do think that some of what is now happening in Eastern Europe has caught even the communists by surprise. They have known that their economy is in bad shape, but I don't think they've known it was in as bad a shape as we now all see it was. So they've been caught a bit by surprise in what's happening now in Eastern Europe, and they're doing what they can to save the situation. And it remains to be seen just how successful they will be. But even though they now try to cope with serious real problems, which they do have behind the Iron Curtain, I am quite sure that they are grateful for it, if only for one reason, namely that the West will probably look away from what they will continue to do in Central America, and I predict they will accelerate right now in Central America what they have been doing there for some time.
Which is
to work for the takeover of strategic countries in Central America in order to bring down the United States.
Are we doing anything effectively to counteract these moves by the communists?
I've been gone from America now for 9 years, Ken, so it's difficult for me to see. Now living in Australia, we're more concerned in Australia with what's happening in the Philippines than with what's happening in Nicaragua, understandably. But nevertheless, at that distance now from the States, and not being as acquainted with the Central American developments as I'd like to be, it still seems to me that the United States has not accurately, at the top level, from the White House down, analyzed the seriousness of the communist infiltration into Central America, if only as it relates to the long-term viability of the United States, if nothing else. And, of course, this Americans must insist that the administration must do by yesterday.
You know, it's funny, Doctor. I went to Europe a number of years ago, and particularly Spain, Portugal, and Morocco. And as I walked through the cobblestone streets of Madrid and places like that, and saw buildings and houses and castles that were thousands of years old, you stop and you think and you say, wait a minute, I live in a country that's only 200 years old, a speck, a fly speck on the world as far as time is concerned. And all these great civilizations that have been here, come and gone, Rome, that lasted, what, 700 or 800 years, something along those lines, and gone. And owned the world at one point in time. And you realize how fragile a political system really is. We tend to take things for granted, I think, and we have to be on guard, and that's what you're really preaching here today.
I think that's true, Ken. America, of course, is the great wonder of technology and the highest standard of living in the world of any country of more than 200 million, and about the sixth highest standard of living in the world of all countries, absolutely. It's a tremendous achievement, hardly any poverty at all in this huge country with 250, 260 million people. But being such a young country, as you point out, barely 200, 250, 300 years old altogether, many Americans lack historical perspective, and that's the problem. Second, the way in which Americans elect their president does not help us win the war against communism. Let me explain. Most American politicians want to get reelected and want their man and their party's man to get the presidency or reelected. And this very much tends, as I see it, to get American politicians thinking only 4 years down the track. They're very good on short-term tactics during the next 4 years to get reelected. But that is the ultimate goal, to get their man in the White House. Now, that's a four-year plan, and a four-year plan isn't very effective against a Soviet five-year plan, 10-year plan, 20-year plan. Americans are close, nearsighted. Soviets are farsighted. And so, although the Soviets may blunder tactically, they're right on as far as their strategy is concerned. American politicians, it seems to me, have little or no long-term strategic goals whatsoever, and that's tragic.
We've had, of course, last week we had Gil Ferguson on our program, and who's a local politician, and he indicated in no uncertain terms, of course, something that we've all known and you stated artfully, and that is that the politician's primary concern, first and foremost, is getting elected, and everything else crumbles by the wayside. Next to them getting reelected, we have Wilbur from Garden Grove aboard. Hello, Wilbur.
Well, good morning.
Well, good morning. You're on the air, sir.
Well, I want to make a comment. Many years ago in Indianapolis, Indiana, I lived next door to one of the men who was on the group that founded the John Birch Society. And they had some information that scared me then, it scares me now, that the communists had set their goal to take over by year 2000. And they're right on track on everything they said they were going to do. They've had to take some back steps. And I learned one thing in discussing communism and politics. You can be anti-abortion, you can be anti-gay, you can be anti-anything. But if you're anti-communist, in our country, you're listed as a nut. And nobody listens to you.
Well, I don't understand that. I vow that I'm an anti-communist.
I know, but that is true. You don't find anybody standing up and saying, I'm anti-communist. Not a politician. He doesn't dare.
Well, not a politician.
You can't do it.
Why do you think that's so?
Well, because there are too many people with socialist leanings in our government. You see, there is no communist government. It doesn't work. But socialism does as long as you've got dictators.
That's interesting because I've often said that it seems that our country's moving closer and closer to socialism, and it seems that the communists are becoming more and more liberal, and that someday the twain shall meet. It sometimes seems that way to me.
Well, that is, I think that's true. But in our country, the people who are socialists, we can move out of office.
Well, that's true. That's
but in
true.
Theirs, you can't. And that's a big difference.
All right. Well, listen, Wilbur, thank you for your comment. In a moment, we're going to talk about zigzags. And if you wonder what zigzag's all about, you stay with us. We'll be right back. And this is Impact. I'm your attorney host, Ken Satin. We're here talking about the Ruskies today, folks, communists. And we have an expert with us, Dr. Francis Nigel Lee, who is an author, lecturer, scholar, world traveler. He's been everywhere and generally known as an expert on the communists and the Communist Party. Doctor, you were mentioning something to me earlier about zigzag. What you know, out here when people say zigzag, that's a brand of cigarette paper that back in the drug era they would roll marijuana in. What is zigzag, though, from your perspective?
Zigzag means to walk a little bit in one direction, and then to take a turn and go in the other direction. People who know how to sail will know what I mean. It's called tacking in sailing, against the wind and then with the wind and at an angle, that sort of thing. Now, according to communism, the universe has always existed because there is no God. So the universe behaves and unfolds because of certain zigzag-like laws that are believed always to have been inside the universe, and which are believed will always be inside the universe. The law of contradictions, the law of upward movement, the law of the negation of the negation, and so forth. So they say the universe, even before they were men, always moved in a zigzag, sailing, tacking motion. Now, when they apply this theory to revolution, they come up with something like this. Lenin said, if you want to climb up a mountain to get to the top, you don't run up it in a straight line. You zigzag your way up the mountain. And he wrote a very important book called One Step Forward, Two Steps Back. And, of course, if you study the history of communism, especially since the takeover of the Soviet Union in 1917, you'll see this is what they've done all the time. That's what their new economic policy was about. One step backward to bolster their economy before they get ready to go forward again. That's what's now happening right now in the Iron Curtain countries, bashing holes in the Berlin Wall. It's zigzag. It's like a man that wants to drive a 6-inch nail into a plank. If you get a hammer and press the head of a hammer against the 6-inch nail's head, nothing happens. You've got to belt it in with a hammer, and each time you've got to take the hammer away from the nail before you bring it down and bash it in further. The trouble is, every time the West sees the communists take the hammer away from the nail, they say, hey, yippee, communism is over, communism's dying, whereas actually they're just getting ready to belt the nail again, much deeper into the plank than it's ever been before. Zigzag.
So, all right, well, I thought your analogy to tacking really brought it home for me, frankly, as far as sailing's concerned. So we should not be so optimistic right now. I mean, even though we see all this revolution, or what appears to be revolution, and in Czechoslovakia and all these places where they're lining up in the squares, they're screaming and yelling and demonstrating, these seem to me to be this is an outrageous kind of conduct to allow the press to see in communist countries. And as you said, apparently it even took them a little bit off guard, but it's all a part of a big game plan then.
Well, it's great I'm in L.A. now, which is near Hollywood. Now we'll all understand it. If you've got a movie that runs for 2 hours, it consists of thousands of frames of celluloid, each of which has a still picture. Now, what we're in danger of doing now is forgetting the movie and just looking at one frame in the movie and saying, hi, this is great, look what's happening. But, of course, anyone with any brains should know that that one frame is from a movie, and the scenario 5 minutes on from where the frame is going to be quite different to the one frame you're looking at. We must not absolutize the present situation in Eastern Europe as if it's the end of the game. It isn't. It's a hiccup in the indigestion which both the West and the Iron Curtain countries have thus far, and the Iron Curtain countries are playing the movie.
Well, so and they're going to play it with our money, apparently. If the things keep going the way they're going, we're going to finance them, it seems like.
In Technicolor.
All right, we have time for another call here. Charlie from Anaheim is with us. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Ken, Dr. Lee.
Yes, sir, Charlie.
You know, the one flaw in Marx's writings that he doesn't accept the fact the innate desire of man to be free. And what is happening over there in the Soviet is that the people have been exposed to the Western culture and materialism, and they realize they're not free.
Well, I agree with that. That is a serious flaw. Not, by the way, just the one flaw. There are many flaws, but that certainly is one of them. Although, you know, Marx's associate,
Engels,
he does say that man will become free, namely after communism, when man merges with nature.
Yeah, so, one of their phrases is, throw off your chains, you slaves. You know, they consider, when he wrote Das Kapital, he didn't understand capitalism and the way it works and the beauty of it.
Yeah, that's true.
Well, okay, we have a... Charlie, you're a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist, sounds like.
I am.
All right, well, thank you for calling. As always, Charlie's is one of our regular callers, calls us with it. Always an opinionated fellow. We always like to hear from him. Dr. Lee, what is the communist device known as logomachy?
It's not so much a word that they use, but it is a word that wise Western anti-communists use to describe the way communists operate, and they really do operate that way. What it simply means, logomachy means to know how to fight with words. So communists will deliberately take a look at the West and find nice words in the West which Western people like. Words like peace, words like democracy. And then the communists, in their dialogue with us, will deliberately use those words. They'll say, we are for democracy. We are for peace. When they say that, under their breath and not for our consumption, by peace they mean the West must be manipulated into a situation where it slowly surrenders to communism without armed resistance. By democracy, they mean all people that think the way the communists think should be marshaled together, and all people that don't think the way the communists think should be isolated and liquidated. But the West stupidly hears these nice words coming from the communist, peace and democracy, attaches the Western meaning to these words, which is very unwise, because we need to figure out what our opponents mean by words that they use, words that we also use with a different meaning, and in that way they deceive us further.
Dr. Lee, a quick question. What would happen to the world if there were no United States?
Well, it's God's world, so the world will survive even without the United States. But I believe God has given the United States the terrifying responsibility of leading the free world at this very critical point in history. What scares me is the lack of foresight of many American and other Western leaders about what needs to be achieved long-term, especially when we look at an ideology like communism.
All right. Well, Dr. Lee, I want to thank you very much for having joined us today. It's been very elucidating, and we appreciate it, and good luck on going back to Australia. Have a good, safe flight, and I hope there's no Pakistani bombs or anything out there.
Thank you, Ken. I've enjoyed being on your show.
Right now, so I've got that on tape then.
I'm Francis Nigel Lee, Professor of Systematic Theology at the Queensland Presbyterian Theological Seminary in Australia. I migrated from the United States, Tennessee, to Australia 9 years ago to take up this post. The Lord has been blessing us very much there the last 9 years. I am a lawyer turned philosopher turned theologian turned writer turned seminary professor. And I'm interested in all of these fields.
All right. A couple of things I'd like to touch on would be the Islamicization of many parts of the world. Would you say that Australia is facing, similar to Great Britain, an influx of Islamic thought and philosophy, as well as a large number of Muslims?
I think that process is just beginning in Australia at the moment. As you know, Australia had a very restrictive immigration policy, confined only to people from Northwest Europe until as late as 1975. Although, after World War II, migration policy was softened somewhat to permit the influx into Australia of people from Southern Europe, especially Italy, Greece, and Yugoslavia. Now, some of the Serbs coming from Yugoslavia were Muslim, but most were Christian, either Roman Catholic or Serbian Orthodox or some other branch of Orthodox Christianity. And many, of course, were secularists. Until then, there really was no Muslim influence at all in Australia, except from the descendants of Afghan camel drivers that were brought into central Australia perhaps almost 100 years ago to organize these camels as a means of transport. Then they're still around. Some of them are still fanatically Muslim. Some have become secularized. But then, since then, a great number of Turks, Lebanese, half of them, Muslims, Egyptians, and people now from all over the world are streaming into Australia, so that at the moment, out of a total population of 16 million, I guess about 3% already are Muslims.
Okay. In the inner cities in the United States, a lot of evangelical churches have left, gone to the suburbs, and in their place are mosques being erected. Is that happening in the major cities of Australia as well, that kind of a movement?
I think we're just about to see the start of that kind of movement on a small scale. In the city in which I live, Brisbane, in northeast Australia, a city of about 1 million, every day I go past a little Baptist church that folded about 10, 20 years ago, which they sold to Muslims. They have now turned it into a mosque with Arabic written all over it. And I imagine this will continue to some extent, but on a small scale.
Okay. Now, Australia, of course, there are many other peoples than those from the Muslim background. What about those coming from Southeast Asia and other places? Are there still a lot of refugees flowing into the country from those countries as well?
quite a few, chiefly from Vietnam, who, of course, would not be importing Islam, but Roman Catholicism. Some Indonesians, who would indeed be strengthening Islam, but not Islam of the more fanatical Near Eastern variety, because Islam in Indonesia, as you probably know, really has to some extent syncretized with pre-Islamic Hinduism there, and it's not as fanatical as in Arabian countries. Also, they've had three centuries of Dutch missionary attempts, which have made some headway in Indonesia. Philippines, I suppose there would be some Muslims settling in Australia from the Philippines, but not too many, mostly Roman Catholics again. So that's about the state of the nation at the moment.
Okay. Are churches in Australia prepared to deal with any rise in Islam?
Any what in Islam?
Rise in Islam, the spread of Islam. Do Christians
within Australia?
Right. Are they, do you feel they're equipped, or is there need to be a lot of educational on that line?
Yes, I think so, but at the moment it's not yet a sufficiently real enough threat. There are some churches who are establishing Arabic-speaking congregations. I should mention that you've got almost 500,000 people in Sydney who are Muslims and mostly from Turkey and Lebanon, all living in a ghetto-sort situation where street after street after street, you'll hear very little English spoken, but only Turkish or Arabic. Again, though, this is just the past couple of decades. I think it was very surprising when, with the furore that broke out over Rushdie's book recently, that some of these Muslims in Australia took to the streets very angrily, which is very unusual in Australia, where people are pretty lethargic as far as any religion is concerned, and particularly where such a small minority in the nation should become so outspokenly aggressive on a matter like this in a country such as Australia. I think that made quite a few Australians sit up and take note.
Okay, fine. Let me go check the tape, and then we'll
okay.
A couple other questions I want to ask, too.
Just park it there.
Okay, we'll find that link.
That's great.
If you can just summarize, what are some of the spiritual needs in Australia at this time? How could Christians in this country pray for the spiritual life in Australia?
Of most Australians. Yeah, I think that's the best you could do, is to pray that the Spirit of God may stir up the rather lethargic Australian churches and give them a more aggressive leadership. I don't think it would be productive to send American missionaries to Australia, which is being done. They are either regarded as screwballs or as kooks or enthusiasts by Australians. Americans are outgoing, friendly people that come over real strong. Australians are retiring. They don't like that at all. And they often feel very antagonized by that kind of a emotional, hyped-up approach, as they would regard it. So I think if Australia is ever to be evangelized, it's going to have to be done by the churches that have been there for some time, but which are in a state of lethargy, or as the average Australian would say, they're balanced and not fanatical about their religion. So I'd say pray for us.
How about the intellectualism in Australia? Has there been any major inroads of being able to share the gospel with those in real positions of high academic standing?
Academic standards in Australia, amongst the intellectuals there, I would say are considerably higher than they are in the United States in that bracket. Australians know it. They're aware of the superiority of their educational system to that of the United States today, which is unfortunate because they tend to look down on things American as being not quite up to that educational par. On the other hand, they do get excited about trashy American humanist programs, which are dumped even by the American public school system. These things, like Semp and Makos, seem to find a ready market in Australia amongst the many agnostics and even atheists, even in the teaching profession there. I'd say we're just at the beginning in Australia as Christians of seeing the intellectual ramifications of the gospel in terms of Christian education, specialized Christian non-church organizations geared to reach the intelligentsia. But they have been started. I'm involved to some extent. We're making some headway. But because of decades of neglect, it's coupled with the natural Australian reticence toward dogmatic religion, it's a hard and an uphill fight. It's at least 30 times as easy to talk about Christ to an American as it is to an Australian, at least 30 times easier.
Now, is there a large influx, too, of Eastern religion, Hinduism or TM or some of the other...
It's gods? Beginning now. It's not yet large. Of course, Buddhism is coming in to some extent. Not far from where I live, there's a Hindu gentleman, complete with turban, that goes for a morning walk, and we're quite used to seeing him. Very distinguished-looking gentleman. But that's so unusual that I note it as unusual.
And then just lastly, is there an urbanization movement happening in Australia as well?
Most non-Australians have the completely incorrect perception of Australia still being largely, if not predominantly, an agricultural country. That's quite incorrect. For nearly 100 years now, Australia has been one of the most urbanized countries on earth. It's huge, as big as the continental United States. It's empty. Only 16 million people live there, population about 2.5 square mile. But almost the entirety of that population, for nearly 100 years now, has been living in only six cities. So very few Australians live outside of those six cities.
That's funny. So it is urban, although there are many rural areas as well. So, but the people are mostly urban.
The nation, the Australian nation, I would say, off the top of my head, it has for 100 years been at least 90, and I would say today at least 96% thoroughly urbanized, and not first generation, but third, fourth, fifth generation urbanized.
Is there any deterioration taking place in the inner city? Slums, ghettos, what have you?
A little bit, but nothing like what you've got in the much larger American cities, which, of course, are far more cosmopolitan also than Australia's thus far.
Dr. Lee, thank you very much.
You're most welcome.